Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're discussing Shirley, the new film from Josephine Decker, named after, but only maybe fairly loosely, about the horror writer Shirley Jackson. Jackson was the author of strange novels and short stories, probably best known for The Haunting of Hill House, twice turned into a film, and a sui generis, horrible short story, The Lottery, published to much success and outcry in The New Yorker in 1948. Shirley Jackson also wrote two volumes of memoir, brilliantly titled Life Among the Savages and Raising Demons. So yes, we're in that territory. Josephine Decker's Shirley is a dizzying, sticky and claustrophobic thing set in Bennington, Vermont in the early 1950s. Shirley and her college professor husband have their bored, quarrelsome, boozy marriage interestingly interrupted by a cute young couple, Rose and Fred, recently eloped and with a baby on the way, who need a roof over their heads. Power shifts between hopeful youth and manipulative experience. Venn diagrams of nastiness and madness expand and contract as Jackson prompts Rose to wonder about a real-life spook story of a girl who got lost in the woods nearby. The house itself, while no haunted gothic manor, is a big, oppressive place, drawing on Jackson's own obsessions with domesticity and ritual, the sacred writing room, and too many empty bottles in the waste paper basket. The cast are key in this strange ensemble work. Elizabeth Moss, who also produced the film, plays the horrifically talented Shirley. Michael Stuhlbarg, her controlling and jealous husband Stanley. Odessa Young is an innocent, or is she, Rose? And Logan Lerman is the ambitious, possibly unfaithful Fred. Much to discuss about Shirley today, and to do it, I'm joined by the literary critic and writer Lucy Scholes, who also presents the Our Shelf podcast, and the film critic and host of Girls on Film podcast, Anna Smith. Welcome both to the programme, and apologies for my overlong intro. We are in very rich territory, though, with Shirley Jackson and indeed with Josephine Decker's film, Shirley. Lucy, I'd like to start with you. This is a film that sort of plays fast and loose with the realities of Shirley Jackson's life and calls on elements of her fiction as well to tell its story. But maybe you can give our listeners a little bit of a thumbnail portrait of Shirley Jackson's sort of real life and works.
Well, as you say, yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, and the film is very much based on a novel that was written called Shirley rather than a definitive biography, though there is a brilliant one by Ruth Franklin that people can turn to if they want to know more. So Jackson was a writer. She was best known during her life probably as, like you said, the author of The Lottery, which was the sort of cat person of its day when it was published in The New Yorker. People were outraged. They were shocked by it. Some people cancelled their subscription because it was so creepy. Others demanded to know where this terrible story had taken place. They thought it was real life.
Didn't people try and buy tickets? People wanted to sort of, yeah, be able to visit the place and buy tickets for the next, well, we don't want to spoil it, but the next event.
Yeah, which in a way is astonishing and says more about those people than anything else, I think.
How America's changed.
Exactly. So she was very well known for The Lottery. She was also better known, I think, for her for the memoirs that you talked about, Life Among the Savages and Raising Demons, rather than her sort of more macabre, haunting, ghostly stories that we have come to recognise her for today. But she lived in Bennington, in North Bennington in Vermont, where her husband, the literary critic and the professor, was teaching at the college there. And she was a mother, a homemaker and a writer, and she sort of fitted her writing in between raising lots of children, which I think is something we'll talk about in relation to the film, obviously, in a little bit. And she suffered from agoraphobia later in her life. She was a heavy drinker, and she struggled all her life, although she was successful, she struggled all her life with quite a complicated relationship with her own mother, who never thought that she was conventionally pretty enough or attractive enough to be, like, her mother wanted her to be a better woman by those sort of 1950s standards of the day, and Shirley didn't. She wasn't conventionally beautiful. She wasn't the best housekeeper. I mean, I think she was a very loving mother, but she certainly was quite happy to put the dishes on hold and do her writing instead.
There's a line in the film where I think, doesn't she say something like, you know, domestic order is a sign of limited intelligence or something along those lines. She's got a bit of a kind of Iris Murdoch vibe about it. The dirtier,
exactly,
the dirtier the draining board, the better the books or something, right?
Yeah, and I think there was definitely that feel to it. But at the same time, she was certainly not, she might have been a bit of a sort of domestic slattern in the more traditional sense, but she certainly wasn't somebody who didn't enjoy the sort of, you know, being around her children or that side of her life. So there are different portraits and different ideas, I think, of what she was like.
Anna, lovely to have you on the programme as well. Maybe you can give us a bit of, from the film side, Josephine Decker, what's her sort of track record as a filmmaker?
Well, she's a really interesting filmmaker that I've had my eye on for a while. She's been a guest on Girls on Film. It will not surprise you to learn. She's an actor and she's also a performance artist as well as a filmmaker. And I think that informs a lot of her work. And that style has seeped into a lot of her work. I mean, she's been quite prolific just in the last few years, really. She did a psychological thriller called Butter on the Latch in 2013, and then she followed that up with Thou What's Mild and Lovely in 2014, and then Madeline's Madeline 2018. And all those have been quite personal, independent films, quite experimental in structure, always featuring around women. I mean, she's very much a female filmmaker who is interested in exploring the relationships between women. And she's not afraid of exploring relationships between women which are difficult and women who are difficult and women who do not conform to the norms. And she's very interested in mental health. So all these things make her quite a curious person and quite an interesting person to kind of merge with the Shirley Jackson story.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like that they were sort of match made in sort of fictionalized heaven, I suppose. And it's an intensely female film and an intensely feminine film. There are themes of the very controlling, manipulative husband, the prof, sort of says at one point near the beginning, "I feel like we're in the Scottish play," and kind of casts his wife Shirley as a bit of a Lady Macbeth. He's perfectly happy to sort of drive her to the edge of madness with his sort of cruel asides and his manipulative ways, isn't he? There is a lot about control and about women giving and taking control in this film, Anna.
Definitely. In many ways, it's a feminist piece of work because it explores the restrictions on women at the time and it explores how its central women fight against them, but also how they are trapped by them and how the men around them, such as, you know, Stanley Michael Solberg's character, might seem permissive and bohemian and encourage his wife's work, but at the same time, he's subtly undermining her all the time. This is quite a darkly funny film, I think. You know, he's to be fair, she gives as good as she gets. You know, they both have very barbed comments and quite nasty conversations with each other, seeming to slightly relish it in a way that is probably fitting for the subject matter. But it's certainly not a world where women find it easy. Indeed, there's a reference to better to be born a boy into this world because the world is so difficult for girls.
Yeah, I mean, and their marriage is a pretty toxic place. And also we should say that whereas Shirley Jackson had four children in real life, she's childless in the film, maybe to draw attention to the relationship that she has or maybe the writing of the books and maybe they would have gotten in the way of that somehow. However, I wonder what we think about that. Lucy, it seems like a strange one to literally kind of throw the babies out with the bathwater to maybe focus on the writing of the works here.
Yeah, and I think at first I was a bit confounded by it because Shirley Jackson in real life, so much of her non-fiction writing was about her children. And also she was very, if anything, having children sort of unleashed an element of creativity in her, that she was able to write these amazing stories like The Haunting of Hill House, you know, We Have Always Lived in a Castle, once she'd had children. So there was no case of it being sort of problematic. However, I'd love to know Anna's opinion on this actually, but the more I watched the film, I sort of realised that I didn't really care that they'd taken the children out of the plot. And I wondered to a certain extent that whether you even needed them, because there was so much sort of strange and sort of mirroring going on between the two women in the text, between Rose and Shirley, and this kind of strange relationship that was slightly, they weren't even, you know, they were closer than friends. There was some kind of erotic frisson going on between them. What was happening? And that actually, because you had Rose there being the homemaker, she's pregnant when the film starts. And so actually what you got to see was the other side of life at that point. So what it was like for women with children. And I sort of wondered whether you're supposed to slightly look at Rose as this other side of Jackson herself, the more maternal homemaker side, because this is something that Jackson did in some of her novels, particularly in The Haunting of Hill House. She positions two women who are quite opposite, have quite opposite characteristics, against each other, as if between the two of them they will be the sort of feminine whole.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Anna, what do you think to that then? Because it's a bold directorial creative choice, and maybe this comes from the source book, Shirley, but to cut out Shirley's children.
Yeah, I'm in two minds about this one, because part of me does love a good biography, which this clearly isn't a biopic. You know, it's taken from a novel, as you say. But part of me, not knowing much about her life, wanted to know the truth and wanted to know more. And I think the children in there obviously would have given it more veracity and would have. But at the same time, I agree with Lucy that it probably would have got in the way, because this is a really busy film anyway. I mean, if anything, it's too busy. There's so, so much going on. I did like it, but it's very ambitious. And I think to have had any extra central characters in that, or even in the backgrounds, could have created problems. So I think it makes sense, given that the focus of the story is primarily on these two women, but also the two men in their life, and also what Shirley is writing at the time and how all those things feed into each other. And there's also a real sense, there's a dreamlike sense to the film, which, as I understand it, you know, it is also present in her writing. And I think we are meant to question what is real and what is not real, and to look at the symbolism, which we often find in cinema. It's a very common sort of trope in psychological thrillers. Are the two central female characters actually the same person or representative of the same person in some way?
Yeah, I mean, her writing also is, there are lots of sort of split personalities. There's always duality, there's polarity in her books. That's sort of a central theme. And as Lucy said, you know, Eleanor and Theodora, the two female characters in The Haunting of Hill House, have that sort of, they might be two halves of the same person almost. And Lucy, to go back to the books, to see how this film Shirley reflects some of the ideas in Shirley Jackson's fiction and not non-fiction. She's always, I think she's a great writer about getting a sense of place, you know, even going back to that first short story, her breakthrough short story, The Lottery in the New Yorker in 1948. In that opening paragraph, she talks about the kind of lush grass, and I've got an idea of that small town in America, very similar perhaps to Bennington, Vermont, where this awful ritual takes place. Her sense of place is amazing, and the film, the colouring and the grading of this film, the non-spooky but nonetheless unsettling house itself and things like that, there's a lot of colour and amped up kind of sensuousness in this film, isn't there? There is a great sense of place.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, place was something that was so important, and houses in particular are what she sort of comes back to again and again in her work. So in The Haunting of Hill House, obviously you've got Hill House, which I think is probably the book that's being referenced with the most regularity here. But obviously in We've Always Lived in the Castle, there's the house again. And in the novel that preceded that, The Sundial as well, that's set around another big sort of family home. And so, yes, I think so much of the plate, like the house that Jackson's home, the house in which she sort of has to share the space with Rose in this film, becomes as important, I think, as any of the houses that Jackson herself wrote about. And I think many people have mentioned, throughout the years, that the houses in Jackson's work sort of take on their own, they become characters in the stories as important as the humans. And I think this does seem to be being referenced in Decker's work over and over again here, that this sort of the house in which these two women find themselves is the sort of thing that's making their relationship more claustrophobic and more intimate than it otherwise would be, obviously.
Anna, this is a sort of very, as I said, it's a very colourful film. It doesn't go for the kind of tropes of kind of the gothic horror, although there are dreamlike moments and there are some shocks and bumps in it. We're not in a kind of cobweb choked gothic mansion here, are we? A lot of it seems to happen in high summer. How does that sort of play in, and what's the atmosphere of the film? Because it feels very hot to me.
It does, and it feels quite claustrophobic, which I think it's meant to, because obviously, you know, the central character is agoraphobic and is sort of suffering from mental health problems, and I think that's reflected in a lot of the cinematography. And regardless of being bright, the use, as you say, the sweat and the close-ups and the giddy angles that make you feel a little bit sick and a little bit woozy sometimes, it's uncomfortable. And the soundtrack, too, just refuses to let you settle into this film. I think that might be something that really alienates more mainstream audiences and really puts Decca's experimental stamp on it, because it's often a discordant soundtrack that draws attention to a lack of harmony in what we're watching, which, you know, has its own kind of horror elements, but it certainly isn't that, as you say, traditional spooky haunted house, dark, you know, things going on in the corner horror in many ways. And I think it's testaments to Decca actually that it's not that, and that she's tried something a little bit more inventive, and something which is a reflection of the human mind and the minds that it's exploring.
The way the film is sort of very beguiling, and the colours are very brilliant. The performances are great. We will come to the performances, because they are all, I think, uniformly excellent. But that idea of domesticity and ritual, and I do mean witchcraftery kind of things, but also I mean domestic ritual and things like that. Can you tell us the place of the domestic in Shirley Jackson's fiction and non-fiction? Because when she kind of had a bit of a cultural rebirth, sort of 10 years or so ago, this phrase domestic noir came up. And she's, for a horror story writer, intensely domestic somehow as well, isn't she?
Yes, I think so. I mean, everything that she writes is grounded in the domestic. And I think she's somebody who is fascinated, clearly, by that environment and, you know, the horrors that can kind of lurk within. And I suppose also using ideas of the uncanny, because it's such a familiar environment, but yet the kind of terrible things that can happen there. And I think it's like we were sort of saying earlier, it ties in very much with the era during which she was writing. She was clearly, I mean, I don't know, I'm always, one doesn't want to always try and map a writer's, you know, private life onto their writing, but there was clearly something going on in terms of the way that she was trying to work through ideas of how claustrophobic a domestic environment could be, particularly for the women inside it. And I think, like, you know, like we've said, we see this in so much of her fiction. And yet at the same time, when she writes the non-fiction about her domestic environment, the trials and tribulations of living with her children in Raising Demons and Life Among the Savages, there's a really kind of dark, very funny edge to that she's able to kind of extract such humour and sort of farce from these situations. And they were the books that made her the most money when she was writing. I mean, they were the ones that were bestsellers. They were the things that, you know, meant that she was earning more money than her husband. And so I think, to take it back to maybe the resurgence a few years back of being people being very interested in her work and as a writer of domestic noir, that was great on the one hand, because it was starting to realise that she really was an important author. But I think what's been done more recently is that critics like Ruth Franklin, who's written the wonderful, very good biography, if people are interested, of Shirley Jackson, called A Rather Haunted Life, that came out quite recently. In that, Franklin sort of rescues Jackson from just being a sort of women's writer. She rescues her and puts her up there with people like Henry James. She says, like, you know, the turn of the screw is just as good as any of Jackson's work. And she starts to kind of see her in a grand American tradition of sort of horror and ghost stories from, you know, Henry James, Hawthorne, Poe, these kind of writers. I think the domestic is very important, but I'm also wary of trying to see her within just that environment.
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting thing that seems to maybe be a starting point for her, but in no way is she chained to a kitchen sink? She's got a pen in one hand and a colander in the other. I mean, that's not what I mean by that, but it is. It's as you say, it's the uncanny in the everyday.
And exactly. And I think, yeah, in a way, it's not that I think. I mean, I'm a big fan of domestic horror. I think it works wonders because it's something that is known and familiar, and then it turns horrifying. So I think it's not even the case of trying to rescue her from that as much as recognise that there is a great value to this writing, just because it's not set in the. I mean, obviously. some of her work is set in the stereotypical haunted house, but, you know, she's just as good as Henry James in The Turn of the Screw, and his is a domestic environment there, but we don't like to think of it like that because he's a man, maybe. And I do wonder if Decker's doing that a bit in making, in not having the children. It's sort of also saying, like, here's going to, we're going to look at Jackson as this kind of art monster figure and not give her this, you know, she's not just the mother, and, you know, as well, she is somebody in her own right who we should value as a creative force.
I will go halves on you on writing the script called Art Monster, Lucy.
Let's do it.
I'll do the beginning. You can do the twist. Anna, we've got to talk about these wonderful performances. Elizabeth Moss, to my mind, owns Shirley. She's so good.
She is such a tremendous actor, and you just know that she's going to deliver this character perfectly, and she does. I'd say it's an inventive, surprising performance. I mean, she's very good at glowering. There's a lot of glowering and very piercing stares. You know, she can absolutely terrify.
And the Oscar for glowering goes to Elizabeth Moss.
She has a lot more than that, but really, those meaningful stares. So she's fantastic at that. And she's also absolutely free of vanity. And I think that's another great thing about this film, you know, is that it's not trying to sex anyone up or dress anyone up. She was a woman who was, you know, allegedly quite plain looking and dresses in a fairly frumpy way, isn't particularly interested in her appearance. And all of that is a strength of this film and embraced by Elizabeth Moss in a performance which is not at all vain. And she's definitely got a different physicality for this role. And she also has a great deal of relish and that wonderful glint in her eye when she's scheming up something very, very clever and very, very mean. And I think that's a trait which really fits with the character beautifully. But she also has the tenderness, and then, of course, she has, you know, the vulnerability of someone who's suffering from mental health problems. So I think she covers that whole range and more beautifully.
And Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays Stanley, her husband, that's a great performance. He's got this manic, sort of slightly perverted kind of creepiness about him. He's sort of quite, sort of, he's got a polarity in his behaviour as well. He's very believable as the kind of philandering prof, isn't he? And that's quite a... Yeah, it's a quite a manic performance.
Definitely, and I think it really fits tonally with her performance as well. I mean, I really liked him in Call Me By Your Name, and he's almost like the polar opposite, but the same character in this, because that was a very nice, understanding, kind, intellectual kind of role. Here, he's the intellectual who's, you know, insecure, and he's rather mean, and he's cheating, and he's jealous, but also, you know, very loving as well. You know, there are a lot of contradictions going on which he embraces, and he also has a lot of fun with the dark humour as well. So yeah, he can do a lot with a glance too. So I think his performance is tremendous. I think Odessa Young is really good in this, because she's still fairly new. I've seen her in The Daughter, but not many other things. And she is the character who is initially presented as very pristine, you know, the nice little wifey, as they say in the film. And then the journey that she goes on throughout the film, it gets more and more extreme without giving away spoilers. And she really handles that well. And she and Elizabeth Moss start to play off each other rather brilliantly. Logan Lerman is, as he needs to be, slightly in the background, the handsome young professor who is perhaps easily led and ambitious, and for whom life comes a bit more easily than his probably equally intelligent wife.
Yeah, there are some surprising facts. I really want to get them in before we head off to your further reading. And that is our friends at the Backlisted podcast. Lucy, I know you've been a guest on that programme as well. They did a programme on We Have Always Lived in the Castle, the Shirley Jackson book. And some of the facts that they found, that Andy and John found there, and Andrew Mail, who's the guest, one of the guests on that, were amazing. So Stanley Hyman, in real life, he refused to enter Shirley Jackson's study because she didn't have all of her books ordered in alphabetical order. She wrote three diaries, I think, in three separate voices. And he hated this and distrusted it and tried to destroy them, I think, and said that you should stop writing even one of these diaries, because that each one is worth $40, you know, as in her writing took off, and it was like a waste of invoiceable writing, I suppose, to keep it in a journal. He was quite a toxic kind of guy, and obviously did not dandle the four children on his knee either, it seemed. So some amazing stuff like that. And Lucy, I think you referred to this at the beginning with your portrait of Shirley Jackson, that the amazing an awful relationship she had with her mother, where her mother said to her that she was the proceeds of an unsuccessful abortion. I mean, can you imagine what that does to... No wonder she was lucky to only be agoraphobic.
Yeah, I think what came out of the Ruth Franklin biography as well was that Jackson had spent a lot of time writing not just those diaries, or maybe it was a mixture of diaries, but also letters to both her mother and to her husband that had sort of raised these issues and was kind of pushing back against them and saying, you know, how dare you talk to me like this? But they were never sent during her lifetime. So she was clearly battling against this. But yeah, she had two, I mean... Yeah, she had two. The mother in particular, I think, is really hard to understand. I mean, you know, relationships, God knows how certain couples make it work, right? There's always those confusions. But I think the mother sounded particularly awful.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough stuff. Thank you both very much for your views on Shirley. Now we're going to turn to what it made you think of, actually. Anna, we're going to start with you. And you want to mention Madeline's Madeline. And this is Josephine Decker's previous film from 2018.
That's right. I was a big fan of this film. It was a really inventive, small indie film, really, starring Helena Howard, who's a brilliant young actress who Josephine Decker basically discovered as a young girl who, again, has some mental health problems. And she's also struggling with her relationship with her mother. So her mother is played by Miranda July, who I can do no wrong in my book, who I absolutely love.
Yep, she's excellent.
Yeah, and it's great to see her acting in someone else's film as well, which is quite unusual. And it's about their relationship, but it's also about Madeline, who's played by Helena Howard, and her exploration into theatre and into an improv company, and how that then plays into her life. Molly Parker is also brilliant, playing the teacher and the woman sort of running this rather daring, slightly pretentious improv troupe. I think there's a little bit of self-referential knowing sort of element from Josephine Decker here, slightly laughing at the absurdities of that kind of setup, while also using that kind of setup to make the film, because the film itself was based a lot on workshops. You know, she herself was directing, you know, the actress and sort of trying to weave her own life into the story as Molly Parker's character is. So it's very self-referential, but it's also funny. It's also, I think, got something to say about female relationships, particularly mother-daughter relationships. And also, like, you know, Shirley, it's exploring women who are complicated and don't have straightforward relationships with each other and who sometimes make quite bad decisions, and that's refreshing.
Well, perfectly put. That is Madeline's Madeline, and that was Josephine Decker's previous film. Lucy, you want to mention Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. How does this tally up with Shirley?
Yeah, well, I think it's like I was just talking about just now. For me, Decker's Shirley captures the sort of essence or the spirit of Shirley Jackson's writing. And I think in doing so that you get closer to a sort of truth about Jackson's life than you might be able to do through a traditional biopic that would be very sort of heavy on the truth. And so the minute I finished watching this, I started thinking about other films which did something similar, which really, you know, departed from the truth, departed from the facts, but managed to capture the atmosphere of something. And the most obvious film I could think of was Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, which I know some people don't like, but I will defend it to my dying day. I think it's a brilliant film. And I think precisely because it manages, through a kind of weird amalgamation of completely sort of inaccurate when it comes to the lots of the details of the history, but it captures the sort of ambience and the atmosphere of what it would have been like to be in Marie Antoinette's court, with its strange soundtrack that is all sort of 80s and you know. And so for me, I don't know, there's something about those types of films which I like. They don't have to be accurate, but they do have to be a sort of, I don't know how you put it, maybe a homage to the writer, the homage to the work. I mean, in Shirley's case, it's a homage to Jackson's work, I think, rather than her life. In Marie Antoinette's case, it's, you know, an homage to a particular period and a woman who has obviously become, you know, there are so many stories as well about Marie Antoinette now, like, you know, it's quite hard to maybe separate fact from fiction. So I'm very interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that. That sort of, it's not a figurative thing. It's a bit more abstract. And you've got, it's a bit like a painting will uncover truths rather than a photograph can't possibly
yes,
do, right? It's a mood piece, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think film has the potential to do this. I'm sure Anna will be able to mention far many more good options as well. You know, there must be loads of other films that do this, but I think film in particular has a real potential to do this with the mixture of, you know, the visuals, the sound, and you can mash so many different things together that might not be historically correct, but when they are all put together, you get something that really works.
Lucy Scholes' historical mashup, Marie Antoinette, directed by Sofia Coppola there. That brings us to the end of today's show. Shirley is streaming on Curzon Home Cinema right now. Thank you both very much to my guests, Lucy Scholes and Anna Smith. I really enjoyed that. Thank you both. There's such a lot to discuss with Shirley Jackson and Josephine Decker's film of Shirley. It's such an enjoyable programme, so thank you very much. Monocle on Culture is produced by Holly Fisher, of course. Join us at the same time next week. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.